You're listening to Brand Enabled, the human stories behind branding. This is the place to gain greater insight into the human side of branding. Join Gabriel Cohen as he sits down with branding experts, sharing real-life stories of how they faced complex issues along their journey. Learn how others are dealing with maximizing the power of brand and get valuable advice straight from your peers. Here's your host, Gabriel Cohen.
I'm really looking forward to this episode because one of the things that's most fun and interesting, I think, when you work on brand is to look at brands and talk to people who have actually transformed categories. Those who have been able to elevate what was maybe previously a commoditized category where there wasn't really maybe a standout brand and create something that's transcendent. I think about Starbucks and coffee. You think about maybe the original one was Nike and tennis shoes. And my most recent favorite one is Yeti and what they've done with the old cooler.
Yeah.
But a lot of those examples are sort of consumer related. In the B2B world, the examples are less common. And that's what I love about Rich Carlberg. So Rich, it's awesome to be catching up and talking to you and to relive and talk about the experience and the leadership that you've shown in transformation that you did at Arrow. It's great to have you.
Thank you.
So maybe start just by telling us a little bit about your background and then maybe a bit about Arrowtronics, because even though it's a Fortune 1000 company, most people never have heard of it.
Okay. Well, Gabe, I thank you for having me. I grew up believing that the answer to the world's problems came through communication. And if people spoke to each other with empathy and kindness and that you could really make the world a better place. And conversely, if you speak to people in a negative way, you can really kind of mess some things up. And I've always kind of wanted to be a part of doing stuff that made things better for people. And so I'm a communications professional and kind of a marketing professional, having produced some television shows, having gone to school for English and communication, coupling that with an MBA. So there's some business principles in there, and using my skill set, hopefully, to make things better for people in the business context. Oftentimes, that's making people's jobs feel like a value, or making a company the kind of company that, in terms of communicating its message, people say, I'd like to work there, or I'd like to be a customer of that place, and so on and so forth. And being a part of the messaging that would attract people to that has been kind of my life's work from that perspective. Arrow Electronics, when I came to it, was a multi-billion dollar global distributor of electronic parts. They used to say, if it takes a charge, like a battery, or you plug it in, Arrow is there. I have a hard time communicating that in a way that's compelling or sexy, or it's pretty easy to conceive of that as being kind of a commoditized, low price kind of an organization. And so I was tasked with building messaging around that kind of an enterprise. And that's what we did.
I mean, it's the ultimate commodity business, right? If you think about it, because you're not even selling your own products, you're distributing other people's. So when it comes to how customers make decisions, it's like, do you have it in stock and do you have the lowest price? And so therefore the role that marketing plays, the role that brand plays traditionally was very diminished, right? When you walked in, what sort of sparked this? Who had the leadership and vision saying, no, there's an opportunity to bring in someone like Rich Carlberg to come and do things differently?
And you're absolutely right. If five people have the same product and approximately the same price, or exactly the same price, how do you decide which one to purchase from? And if they're the same distance from you, all things being equal, how can you differentiate yourself in a world of just basically flat out equality? And the way to do it is to say that, you know, there's five people, Roger, Sue, Nancy, Gerald. Who are they? And if it's the same price and the same product, I'd like to buy from Gerald because he understands me. Whereas I think that Judy is kind of, this is a transaction, you know, like, hey, let's make a buck thing. This person seems to care for me. And how do you know that? I mean, the only way you can even get that sense is if a company communicates that way with some authenticity. If you buy from us, we just want you to buy. We just want you to be happy. But if you buy from us, you're buying from people who do care about you and care about your success. And we're not going to tell you what your success looks like. You tell us. Tell us what you want to accomplish. And we're uniquely qualified to do business with you because we uniquely care about you. And that's how you can differentiate yourself. Because you can't do it on the product, you can't do it on the price. And so our messaging centered around that. I think that to your question about who brought me in, I think that the company had been around for a long time, decades, and had gotten to a point where it was magnificent worldwide and so on and so forth. But the CEO, smart guy, thought, maybe we can do a little more and we can invest a lot of money in faster manufacturing, faster distribution, you know, blah, 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 blah. But we were putting no money into our own messaging. So what if we put some money into our messaging? Could that help? Probably won't hurt. The company was too big for me to damage it. Mostly likely I wouldn't impact it at all. But if you don't try, you know, nothing's going to happen. So they were willing to try and take a chance on me. Would you communicate something about this company that represents what we stand for and so on and so forth into the marketplace? Because we're not designed to do that. We're designed to get products to people at low cost and fast and everything else. We've got the operations handled. But how would you describe us? And I got that chance.
So when you walked in and you started Arrow, what was the context for brand at the time? Like, what did it look like? What did you have?
Yeah, I came in and I said, well, I got to work on the brands. Oh, we've already got that. We don't need you. And oh, good. You know, could I see it? So yeah, here. And they gave me two pieces of paper that showed the logo and it showed the logo lockup. There was no tagline. You couldn't do it. It showed you the color scheme and they go Pantone, what colors it should be. And that was the brand. It was the rules of how you use the logo. That was the brand. And I said, oh, well, okay, I'm not going to take over your job. I'm glad you do this. I'm going to do something different. This is really helpful. Thank you for this, but I'm going to do something different. So I had a wide open opportunity to do things that I considered to be brand that were different from brand standards and guidelines.
And so what was that sort of from to definition then? If brand was just the logo and the standards, what was that to? And then what was the process of getting there?
Yeah, it was from logo and marks to something more, like from Nike tennis shoes, from shoes to something more. What is that more? What is that more? Because they don't need me to help them sell their logos and parts. The logo is in the Museum of Industrial Design. It's a beautiful logo. I can fix the logo. There's nothing for me there. Can you show someone the logo and have it like a Nike logo and have it mean more than a shoe? And so that was the journey we went on.
So how do you do that with an electronics components distributor? Like, how do you do that in such a commoditized category?
I think you start by putting yourself in the shoes of the stakeholders, like the customers, and ask yourself, do they really want this part at the lowest price? Is that what they really want? And the answer is no. The answer is they want their business to be successful. They want their children to be proud of them. They want a lot of human things that transcend a part at a price. So when we thought about that, a lot of customers, they're businesses and they want to be successful. They don't know and this and this. And so what we wanted to position ourselves is being their trusted partner in ways that transcend just the transaction. So then they'd say, well, so if I can buy the part from this company for this price and I can buy it from you at the same price, but you're actually going to provide me with additional market information and additional services, not because you do that and because you're going to charge for it, but because you want me to be successful. Because if I'm successful, I'm a continuing customer. You care about me. You care about me. That's weird. I want to do business with you. And so it's finding something that transcends the existing business. When we started talking, you mentioned a couple of companies. You said, I like the brands that Yeti. It starts from something to, well, because Yeti isn't talking about mugs and stuff. It's a lifestyle. It's not something you expected from the mug. And if I'm going to buy a mug, I can buy a lot of mugs. I want to buy the Yeti mug. Well, why is that? Because it's bigger than a mug and it gets me. It understands me. And you can do that in B2B. If you quiet and listen to your stakeholders and hear what they really want. And if all they want really is price and that, then they don't need me to give some nonsensical message. But when you really strip it back, it's like, they don't care about price. They don't care about anything. They just want to be successful.
But if you'd just gone out and said, we're your trusted partner, that would essentially be pretty much the same words that most other B2B companies that took that next step in elevating their story would do. You went way beyond that.
You're right. And I think it's really important to offer proof points and have integrity, because everybody's going to say, we're your trusted partner. But then they stop. The sentence stops there. Nike gets Michael Jordan to sign on. Go, well, if it's good enough for Michael Jordan, is it good enough for you? When you go play basketball? Or, you know, they offer up proof. They say a consistent message that transcends the product. And then they offer examples to people supporting that that make them think, well, maybe they're telling me the truth. I don't know. Maybe it's marketing. Maybe it's all nonsense. The only way I'm going to find out is buying from them. And I got no reason not to buy from them. It's the same price anyway. They're offering a promise. I'll take them up on it. And then if they lied to me, I'll just discount it. But if you can actually deliver a little bit against what you're telling people and it transcends, like a Yeti mug, bought a Yeti mug. I've not yet really had it transform my life in the way that they might tell me it might, but I still feel good about my Yeti mug. And I say, oh, this is a better mug than any other mug, or a Nike shoe or whatever.
The Yeti example is the difference is it's not just the design aesthetic that they put into it and the experience that they create. There's a flagship store. for example, with a bar inside of it. But where the lifestyle piece comes out is when you're going to the pool, or you're going on a boat, or you're going camping and you're with other people, what does the fact that maybe you've got a Yeti backpack with your drinks inside, what does that say about you in relation to the fact that you're also maybe having an iPhone and an iWatch? So you start to build these brands that you use as a form of self-expression. So they've identified that this notion, these social moments where a cooler comes to play, when maybe people come to your house and you've got your cooler outside in the backyard as well.
You're right. I mean, Yeti can say we're different till the cows come home. Everyone's going to say that. But there's a store. There's a store. There's a Yeti store with Yeti mugs. Nobody's got a store with a mug. They must be telling the truth because, look, I can see it. I can tie. It's right there. Yeah. So they are telling the truth. So it is different. And then all of a sudden, you know, it feeds on it. So you're absolutely right. It's saying something and offering a promise and then giving enough proof points that people say, oh, it's true. It's true. And then you take off. As a marketing professional, I'm with you. It's so much more fun to work on something like that than just the mug company that's doing the mugs and sending the mugs and so on and so forth. It's so much more fun to do one that says, well, here's a bad idea. Let's open a store with a bar in it, with coffee. And a lot of people go, well, that's really freaking inappropriate. That's just ridiculous. But when you work at a place that will allow that and allow you to say, no, 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 don't, watch what happens, And they try it. And if it doesn't work, they shut down the store. But when it does work, and the next thing you know, you're the dominant mug provider in the world. Why? Because your mug's all that great? Yeah, maybe, probably not. Because word of mouth, people, Yeti, Yeti, you got to have a Yeti. Oh, yeah, you know, That's fun.
Yeah. So in your case, the words trusted partner never actually made it out to market. You went way beyond that. What was your approach and process from going from that starting point where a lot of B2B brands maybe even stop to go to something that was much more transcendent?
We kind of had a hunch that the employees didn't want to just work at a commodity place either. They're human beings with kids and families, and that if you gave them a choice, they'd like to work at a place that meant something. And kind of like, so if you're selling mugs, do you want to work an average mug thing or do you want to work for Yeti? It's all the same thing, basically, but one, you feel better. And so when we come into a situation where the brand is two pages and so on and so forth, there's not a lot of thought going into having employees be proud of working there. But when you think about it, the employees would like for customers to be happy. They'd like to be seen as a partner. They like to be seen as wise and trying to be helpful and so on and so forth. So when we put out a message that it's kind of what the employees want anyway, they grab onto it real fast. Like, oh yeah, we're your partner. We're your buddy. We're, you know, whatever. All the marketing and all the messaging in the world gets steamrolled just by the employees buying into it and saying, this is who we are. This is who we are. Think about the Nike, think about the Yeti, and all the employees saying, oh, it's a special shoe, you know, just do it. Or the Yeti, oh no, it's a special mug. Those folks working there, and I've been down there, they're really proud to work there in that thing. And the same thing with Aero, helping employees to be proud of where they work in a way that transcends the basic business model is incredibly powerful. And once you let that genie out of the bottle, employees will run with it. It won't stop. You don't have to spend on the marketing and everything else because they're promoting a message that you didn't come up with. They wanted it. They wanted it so bad. And then you give it to them and they distribute it for you.
Yeah. One of the interesting things that happens a lot in B2B is part of that, we're your trusted partner type stories. It's all built around this idea and this archetype of being the hero. For you, did it just start with trying to shift the mindset of how we think about the role that we play and our archetype?
Yeah, because I think when you say, we want to be your trusted partner, and here's what we're going to do, that is not as powerful as we're going to be your trusted partner, and what would you like to accomplish? The difference is saying that we will listen to you, we will respect you, it's your goal, it's your objective, and we will take our assets and our machine and our company to reach your goal. But we can't do it before you tell us what your goal is. Because if we do that, we're just imposing our presumption of your goal upon you. We're here to help you. And we know your business better than you do. And we know your industry better than you do. And so here's what you need. You need this part at this price. And there you go. We helped you. Okay, that's one approach. The other approach is, Gabe, I want to help you. What can I help you with? What are your goals? What are your aspirations? What would you, where are you going? And if you said, well, I'd like to be a ballet dancer, I say, I might not be able to help you. But if you said, well, I'd really like to invent a new squeaky pig keychain, battery in it, you squeak it. Oh, Aero can help you with that. what would you think about this? You go, oh, thank you. It's saying you're a trusted partner, but not from a marketing perspective, from a genuine perspective of this is the way we would like to conduct business, which is different from the way you'll see business conducted by any of our competitors. And then you decide which one you want.
You're a big fan of the archetype model and framework. What did you decide was a better archetype framework in order to sort of tell that story?
Well, I think that if you're in a category, whether it's shoes or mugs or whatever, and you want to make a change, one of the things is oftentimes products and so on fit into the same kind of archetype. They're all kind of the same because someone's successful and others copy it. If you want to transform something, almost by definition, you have to pick a new archetype. So in the distribution business, commodity, bang, 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 you know, really aggressive, high volume, low margin business, there's a lot of hero brand. And if you want to stand out from that, you got to do something else. And we decided to go at visionary sage, being wise. And just by virtue of communicating differently and being more about a wise sage partner as opposed to a hero solve your thing, we stood out. And then as soon as you stand out, people look at you. I mean, we could have, let's say, been lover brand and been sexy components. People would have noticed it, right? They go, whoa, what's that? They're doing sexy components. Nobody else is doing this. You get the notice. But if you get a brand archetype you can then prosecute, like it'd be pretty hard to prosecute sexy components. You could do it. You could tell jokes about things. But when we really thought about it, we thought the right thing is to be sage, your partner, your wise partner, and so on, and you're different from people, off you go. But I have also found in companies, as soon as you want to be a different archetype, you really freak out the status quo because they've not seen it before by definition. And so they're really like, what have you just done? What did you just do to a company? You're turning us into like advisory, sage, wise people? Well, yeah, because you kind of have to. If you guys want different results, you have to change this stuff. And if you're not uncomfortable, then change it any. So you're asking a lot of the company and when you do this kind of thing, but that's the path.
What was the brand manifestation of that archetype? What was that sort of single-minded idea and ethos that you built out stemmed from it?
We were able to distill it down. And tell me if I've done it and answer the question right, but we were able to distill it down to the idea of guiding innovation forward. Guiding meaning a guide, a partner helping you go to a destination. It's your destination. We just guide. You tell us where you want to go. We guide innovation. We don't guide parts in this. We guide innovation and we guide it forward into the future. And once we were able to distribute that and translate that into 18 languages, the idea behind that stuck. Employees could understand, oh, I guide innovation forward. And then everybody was on the same path. And you saw less creation of content that was funny or sexy or whatever. And it tended to wrap itself around this idea of guiding innovation forward. If you get that messaging right in the first place, then people can go create all kinds of creative and so on. And it'll all harken back to the same fundamental essential idea, which is tied to the archetype and this and that. In the absence of that, most companies don't have that, frankly. What happens is people create whatever they think will work well-intentioned, but it's inconsistent and it's hard to get traction. And so things are just anonymous out there or nobody knows what it is. But if you can hit on something that you can get a whole group of people to like and agree to, it takes off. Can't stop it.
And after getting to that core brand ethos, you then build out the whole sort of concept and idea of 5 years out and the Innovators Club. I think it was when I saw those manifestations of the brand that it really stood out as being differentiated and distinct in the category. Because just those three words themselves, it's like, that's the strategy, which is really important, but it's the execution in its depth and breadth that just go beyond the marketing, but also into culture and experience that I think then really led to the transformation. Can you talk a bit about how you went from that single idea to all these different activations and why it worked?
Yeah, I really agree with you. Even if you get that messaging right, that's big. Okay. But then if you execute it poorly and you do things that don't hit, it won't work. And so once we had gotten to the messaging, then we really sought out like really, really talented people to create messaging. What does guiding innovation forward look like in a video piece of, say, 30 seconds length or 60 seconds, pretty quick to consumable, but shows that in a way that if you watched it, you go, oh, I like it. I understand whatever, whatever. And so we had agencies do that, and they're really good at it when they're allowed to do their stuff, not be told by us what to do, but say, just express this. And then it would come, and it's really video. I mean, we can write this stuff or put it on billboards or whatever, but watching a video and feeling it really move the dials. And I spent a bunch of money on the early creation of content because I knew that if we didn't have great content to start, we would never have any content to follow and I'd be looking for work. So I put a lot of effort into making sure that the first messages out were really powerful messages and that everything else, that would set a bar and a standard for communicating what we were doing that we'd always want to try to measure up to. And that's when we did ads, the Innovators Club, about the world's greatest inventors, Benjamin Franklin and the Wright brothers and Thomas Edison and Leonardo da Vinci. And they're all in a club talking to each other and coincide. And we were really respectful of them, not making fun of them and talking about all the things that, and then tying them into Aero. Like, gosh, I wish I'd worked with, I had someone that was could have helped me when I invented the airplane, the Wright brothers. You know, I wish I'd had an Aero Electronics when I was doing the airplane. And so we tied ourselves into that and the employees were really proud. And they send it out and show it to people and this and that and the other thing. And it just took off because of, frankly, the quality of the production tied to the integrity and ambition of the message.
How were you able to sort of convince internally this notion of actually going and doing was essentially mass market advertising for a very, very B2B orientated company? Because you can get to that brand idea and articulation, but going that step further is even, what was the rationale for that? And how did you make that case internally?
There was no way that I don't have the skill set to convince anyone internally that this is a good idea. There's no way I could do it. What I could do is just get the thing produced. And I didn't ask people their opinion of it before it was done. I just did it. Then we had a spot. It's 30 seconds. And you hit play and you see it. And people are like, oh, this is amazing. And then they'd say, well, Rich, what are you going to do with it? I'd say, oh, that's a good question. What do you think we should do with it? Because I figure, well, if you don't like it, it ain't going anywhere. But if you do like it, the only option is like executives can play it in their home theater, but nobody will see it. But they're so proud of it. It's so beautiful. They want people to see it. Well, we need to have a budget to distribute it. So it was less about convincing people of something than it was showing them something that they were so moved by and proud of that they wanted it out. And then they said, well, here, you have money. Go do it. Go, 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 go. Can I give you a quick analogy? When I go into a fixer-upper home, I can't see it. I just see a mess. But my wife will go and say, oh, if we did this wall and this, and she sees like something beautiful. I think this is crazy. I can't see it. But then go do it. And they walk in. Oh, this is beautiful, right? And I think with marketing and branding, you know, someone like you can see beauty before it exists in this world. But we have to be respectful of people that don't necessarily have that range. And what we have to do is we have to create it for them and then put it in front of them and then let them go, Gabe, you're, wow, I love this. What are you going to do with it? And the answer is kind of, what would you like me to do with it? And if you create bad stuff, they say, bury it. Well, then you're going to lose your job. If you did something, you distributed it and you shot it out there. You don't want to distribute it anyway if they don't love it. If your fellow executives love your work, in my experience, they will find a way to get it distributed. You don't have to ask for anything. And they will distribute it to the level of their comfort. And then when they see the response from the market like it, we'll give you more money. We'll give you more money. We'll give you more money.
So too often we stop short. We don't get to the vision because we try and sell it when it's still conceptual with the words. It's almost as if there's a lesson that we can all learn from HGTV shows.
Yeah.
And yeah. Imagining the reaction of the couple when they walk into the home and they actually see it for the first time. But it wouldn't have the same impact if you had property brothers, whoever they are, just describing it to the couple. They have to walk in and see it.
You're right. And if someone came to me with just the idea and I don't have the skill set to see it, what my natural inclination is going to be to kill it and say, no, darling, I'm sorry, we're not going to buy that house because I'll kill beauty. Not because I'm dumb. I'm being asked. I'm not qualified. And so better for me not to know what's going on. Just, I support you. Go do it. Come back. And if it's a disaster, well, we'll live and learn and move on.
Talk about then where you went next, because then you went, you did something that was even bigger and bolder, which was the Sam car. Talk a bit about that.
It was sort of unintended, but one of the consequences of doing things that people think are they like is that they come back and say, can we have more of that? Can we have more of that? Go, uh-oh, now we got to go. Okay, now we got to keep going. And I had had a lot of success in the first piece in letting creative people just do something amazing. And so we tried that again and we found another agency. But we wanted, this is going to shock you, Gabe, but Benjamin Franklin actually did not work with us, nor did the Wright brothers. So we were kind of out there telling a fairy tale, as it were, you know. And so we wanted to find, okay, now we got to find an actual story to inspire and so on and so forth, where we actually did something. And the criteria for us in that was, okay, it has to be special. It has to be never having been done. It has to live up to the brand promise of we're smart, we're special, we're unique, we can help you. So who did we help? We helped a quadriplegic race car driver by creating something that had never been done by using technology, by building a car that he could drive using his head only, and turning that into a spot. It was less about the technology of the car and less about the aero thing and more about the positive impact on somebody's life who had had their dreams taken away from them through technology and through our experience and our company. We were able to deliver on their dream. What we were talking about earlier about what is your dream? And as a quadriplegic, my dream is to race a car again. Okay, Aero is your partner for that. These other people get your parts fast, low cost, whatever, commoditized. We will help you realize your dream. This was the manifestation of the Aero promise. A person with a dream. It seems impossible. It's never been done before. And the next thing you know, a race car driver who's a quadriplegic is a race car driver again. And that is telling a story that transcends the business, but speaks to the soul.
Yeah, that's a beautiful, amazing story. And then that Sam story, it didn't stop there at that first ad, right? I think one of the great examples of your core brand idea is that it lived on for the 7 years that you were there at Aero and probably still lives on today, even beyond.
Was probably like, I think Michael Jordan lives on for Nike. I mean, it lives on. It also, that story, because it wasn't about the company and it wasn't about business and so on. It was about humanity. It showed up on all over the world, on BBC, on NBC Nightly News, on, you know, I mean, the media around it was staggering. Sunday Morning did a spot on it. And so the value of the distribution of the message was shocking. The expense of actually having created it was de minimis compared to the outcome. I think that happens when you create stuff that really moves people on an emotional level. It has way, way, way more bang for the buck than if you're kind of being transactional with your communications. And so, yeah, we had it. He drove up Pikes Peak. He raced at the Indy 5. He raced Mario Andretti, on and on and on. But I will tell you this, Gabe, out of all those stories, the next one that was produced that really mattered to people was Sam went to Las Vegas and he got his driver's license in Nevada. Just a simple thing we all take for granted is we have a driver's license. And when we filmed him getting his driver's license, and then for the first time since he was injured, taking his daughter for a drive, I mean, it just makes you cry.
So if we then shift internally, at what point did you know that the storytelling, what you were doing was moving people internally as well, whether it be salespeople, customer-facing people, or even feedback from customers? Like, how did that start to connect?
I think in our department, you could kind of tell because people from around the world, if they saw something, they'd call in and say, can I get a copy of it? Where do I find this? We weren't sending it so much to folks as we would show it to them, and then they would ask for copies. If we would show something and nobody asked for it, then we knew it wasn't really hitting. It wasn't hitting at a level where they wanted to. They were so proud of it, they wanted to show it to somebody. So we could see those requests coming in from all over the world and knew, okay, this one's working. If we produce stuff that nobody ever wanted to see again, you just kind of let it go. And I think that's really interesting, Gabe, just allowing things to have their natural momentum, not producing something and putting so much money in it and effort and my own self-esteem and ego into it that now we got to force it on everybody. But just trying your hardest to do something really beautiful and then letting it go. And if people don't like it, that's okay. If I really knew what people liked all the time, I would be the richest person in the world. I'd be right all the time. I'm wrong all the time. So, but the only way for me to find out is by setting it out there and then watching the uptake internally. Let's go put it on TV. Let's just run it internal first. See if our employees respond to it, it'll work externally and then going from that.
I love the idea of the momentum and the continuity. And you even drove that into brand training as well. Like how you talk about how you used even the notion of the Sam car and how you even connected that to internal brand training.
Yeah, we would have ideas like a Sam car, and then we'd say, well, what could we do to make it more either compelling for people? And we thought, well, people seem to like video games. Well, can we turn it into a video game where you play a game? And so we designed a video game and we put it in an arcade thing where you could drive Aero Sam car, where you could drive a Aero delivery truck or whatever. You pick your car and then you dodge things along the way. You play a game and you get points, and signs would come along and you'd stop in front of the sign and it would ask you a brand question. Like, what is Aero's tagline? You go, oh, A, B, C, D, E, just do it. 5 years out, 5 years out. And then you keep driving. Okay. And then you come up to the next sign. And so you're learning about the brand while you're scoring points and playing a game. It's just a matter of saying there are some people, not all people, some people like playing games. A lot of people like playing games. Can we gamify our brand message once we got the message right? And yeah, you can. And that's just one channel, you know, it's gamify it. It's put it on their business cards. It's run a spot and run it in their market, or it's put in all kinds of different ways to distribute, but always thinking of not so much the message, because we had the message. It was, how could we do it in a way that people are going to love this? They're going to love it. They're going to laugh. They're going to talk about it. They're going to share it.
And ultimately, so how did all of this translate into actual results and performance? How do you know that it was worth it?
Well, I believe that this messaging has inherent value because everybody tries to do it, and everybody wouldn't try to do it if it was inherently a bad idea. So inherently, if you do it right, I think it's got a positive impact. And so the first way, we're having to measure it subjectively, which is to say, gosh, all the employees are asking about it. And frankly, the CEO is walking through his day and employees are saying, oh, I love that message. Oh, that, I love that. And he, okay. And he's got, oh, okay. So now all of a sudden he's getting proof points that this is working. Now he doesn't have, we ran and sent a survey and we got an 82.4 on this or, you know, whatever, isn't it? There's none of that, but he's getting this feedback and employees, and you can see it happening. And ultimately with brand at the end of the day, and there's people, I think like even you guys do this in your firm, we'll be able to measure the incremental brand improvement because they say, here's what the company looked like without the brand and here's what it's valued at. And nothing else has changed. The revenue's the same. The margins are the same. Keep the business metrics the same. But all of a sudden it's say doubled in value. That's, they assign that to brand. And in my time at Arrow, we saw that incremental increase that you couldn't explain operationally or in cash flow or something. We saw that increase by billions of dollars. And that was sufficient to justify continuing to fund our business and so on and so forth. If someone really required you to nail it down to a number, we probably could, but it would kind of be lying because I don't think there's actually a way to really precisely measure brand value any more than there's a way to measure the value of the sun or the value of my love of my wife. I can't put a number on that, but it's there, kind of thing.
Yeah, just because something can't be measured doesn't mean it's not important. And that's one of the challenges that we have these days in marketing with the rise of digital marketing, because it's easy to then just follow the things that are easily measurable and then ignore the stuff that isn't because it's ambiguous.
And I think that you're right. And I think that that is where you introduce the potential for competitive advantage, because if everybody wants to run off the math, then everyone's going to run off the math. But if you say, let's do basic math, but then let's take it up a gear, and that other gear is the immeasurable, which is storytelling. I can't measure the value of Moby Dick or the Iliad, but what if we insert that in? What's it going to cost to do that? It's going to cost a little bit to do that. Let's insert it in and see what happens. Well, if done right, what happens is that competitive logjam gets broken and somebody breaks out. And it's always going to be the person that does this brand work that's not measurable. That one's going to take off. And the rest are going to be standing around going, well, what just happened? And then let's copy it. But copying doesn't work. So I love the situations where everybody's measuring, because in those situations, there's the opportunity for greatness.
So everything we've been talking about so far has all been very sort of the curve going that way. Let's get real for a moment and just talk a bit about what were some of the difficult moments in the journey that you had at Arrow or some of the mistakes that you made?
I think that I underestimated. It's hard to bring change to an organization, even when it's successful, especially when you come into an organization. It's already successful before. It's not failing. It's incredibly successful. You're trying to take something that people are really proud of and wonderful and make it even better and by changing it. And it's really stressful to do that because there's no guarantees. I could be wrong. I mean, I probably am. People are critical and skeptical and this and this. And when you're in that environment, for me, it's hard. Just kind of go along with what's there, visible, innocuous. People say, oh, you know, the brand department, they got two pages that tell us about logo and lockup and this and that. They're innocuous. You keep your job, you keep your paycheck, but you're not changing anything. You're not doing anything. Your life's just passing you by and you've managed to protect the logo lockup. But as soon as you get outside of that, it gets stressful. It gets hard. And over time, I was there for, I think, over 7 years. it just builds up and it's stressful. I can't think of anybody that, like, I'll bet you whoever did the Yeti brand stuff or whoever did all those other brands, I bet they're not with those companies anymore. And I don't, they're obviously really talented. They did a great job, but I think it comes with a bit of a price, as does going to college or going to high school, learning math or learning a language or learning how to play the guitar. It's work. And corporate brand work carries with it the same stressors in my experience.
So this is a sort of nice segue into the wisdom round, as we call it. What are your core guiding principles when you think about leading and managing people?
I think they're my own personal core values of integrity and decency and honesty and trying to improve life for people, trying to improve life for the employees, the shareholders, the company, its customers, all of it, trying to do something good for others. I think that by staying true to that, not trying to make an extra buck or trying to sell something that's not really as advertised, you're trying to get a quick outcome, but really genuinely trying to improve the working situation and the business environment for people. Staying true to that always led me to positive outcomes. And if we ever had to make a decision, we could measure it by that. Is what we're doing here, are we doing this for our own gratification? Or is this the kind of thing that if we're successful with this, this is going to make the relationship with this company better for everyone involved? And if it met that test, we'd go hard on it.
Some of the work that you've been able to get out of your agency part is amazing and creative, and whether it's big agencies or small agencies, what's your secret in getting the most out of agency partners?
I guess it's understanding that I want to do something great. And in order for me to do something great, I have to empower others to be able to do something great. And so in that case, what I would do is go to agencies and before engaging with them, say, would you mind showing me some of your work? And they'd show me some of their work, but you knew they were showing you the work they were most proud of and their best work. They didn't show you the worst. They showed you the best thing they'd ever done. And I'd say, and it was always really good. I said, that's really, really good. I said, is that the best thing you're ever going to do in your life? I mean, have you peaked? And they get mad at me and go, no. Okay. Well, if there's something better than that, let's do that together. Let's do the greatest thing you've ever done. And the way I'll know that we accomplished it is the next time you have a new client meeting, you show them the work we did together rather than that beautiful thing you just showed me. Always wanted to supplant the greatest work an agency did with our work that we did together.
Yeah, I love that example. The final question before we just get into sort of what you're doing today is, imagine I'm your fairy brand mother. Clearly, there's something deeper that I need to deal with here. And you could be working, or in your career, you could have worked for any brand. What would that brand be?
I think that on paper, that would be the Walt Disney Company, because they strike me as people who understand the value of storytelling without having to have you explain why this is a good idea to have a superhero flying around in an Iron Man suit or something. They get it inherently. And that would take away a lot of the friction around trying to explain. I just wouldn't want to explain the basics of what we do for a living to people. I'd like them to just know that and then get together and produce that work. At a lot of companies, I think you end up finding yourself having to like almost justify your existence. I just wouldn't want to do that going forward. I'd like to be accepted and understanding that if you do this right, this is going to be great for everybody. So please go do it right and just do that.
Yeah, just know you're not going to have to walk in any given day and have to explain to someone the importance of storytelling, right?
Yeah. And that's why I think when we have these conversations with brand people and so on, there's a lot of, well, how do you get buy-in? How do you get buy-in? The only reason you have to get buy-in is because you're working with people that haven't already bought in to the fundamental premise of what you're doing. So when you say fairy god brand mother, I love that. I love that. I need a fairy brand mother. I really need one. So
I'm here for you, Rich. I'm here.
It's already on Indeed. I've already got it out there. There's an opening for a fairy brand mother. But I'd like for my fairy brand mother to put me in a situation where I can focus on the work, the job at hand, and not the whole explanation, justification, being defensive about it, being accused of this and that, wasting company resources, whatever all that is that comes with this, that a lot of folks in our position, Gabe, you know, say, I don't like those conversations, so I'm going to get buy-in in advance. Before I do anything, I'm going to get buy-in. Problem is that, like, as we discussed earlier, if you go down that path, 9 times out of 10, you just get shut down. And then you come back and you go, how do I get buy-in? How do I get buy-in? And it's like, you know, you can't. They don't understand.
So speaking of storytelling and nostalgia, so today you work at Vinyl Me Please, which is a company that's leading the renaissance of vinyl. Talk a bit about your experience at VMP and why has vinyl come back and what is the opportunity that VMP has spotted in marketplace?
And this is weird, Gabe, but right before this, I was downstairs and my mail came and here's my bills. I'm not thrilled about that, but this box came. Lost sounds found. What is it? So I open it up. Whoa. And what's in here? Records. Music. Oh, look, it's... What is it? Oh, Christofferson, Wilson Pickett, Earl Sweatshirt, and Casey Musgraves. And yeah, they're records. And now I can't hear them. I can't, they're just a pain in the neck. And I got stuff all over here. And it came with a sticker, like a NASA. I'm exploring music. And I was so excited to open it. I'm emotionally like uplifted by now I get these records. I know you want one. And I'll get you some vinyl because it's cool. I'm working in this small company where... It's smaller. They really appreciate me. They appreciate what I do. They appreciate storytelling. And they understand when I say what we're selling is not the record and the music, because I can get that off Alexa or whatever. What we're selling is joy and an experience, you know, like, and to me, people I work with, two, the industry I'm in, music and records, three, the ultimate delivery to a consumer, which is not a product, it's a feeling. It's an uplifting. It makes people's day brighter. These things brighten people's days. Okay. I find this to be the pinnacle of my professional life, to be able to marry all those things together and get paid for it, Gabe. Can you believe that?
Well, I'm getting paid for talking to you, Britt, so I can't believe it. So speaking of joy and experience, the time has flown. I loved our conversation. As always, so many wonderful insights. Thanks so much for being on, Rich.
You're wonderful. And it's such a great service you're providing to people to, you know, have these kind of crazy things and so on. And thank you. Thank you for all you do.
And the check will be in the post for that last comment. Thanks, Rich Carlberg.
Thanks, buddy.
That's all for today's episode. We hope these insights from top brand leaders help you as you face your own branding roadblocks. Remember that you're not alone in the challenges you face. And there are always impactful, creative, and human ways to solve brand problems. If you would like to further connect with fellow elite brand leaders and join our community, send an email to gcohen@monogle.com. Thank you for joining us. See you on the next one.